just 100 years ago, I probably would not be making abstract paintings. I would have been making quilts. Why am I so drawn to abstraction? It was so much in my home through the things that were made by the women in my family.
You're listening to Seamside, where we explore the inner work of textiles. I'm your host, Zach Foster, and today we sit down with painter and textile artist, Barbara Campbell Thomas. But before I introduce y'all to Barbara, a couple of tidbits. Number one, we're down to our last review on Apple Podcast, which means if you've ever thought about leaving a review but didn't get around to it, I sure would appreciate you taking a moment the next day or two to do that. Here's what we've got. The last review on Apple Podcast is from Addie XYZ, who says, "My first ever review." How you like that? 5 stars. "Thank you, Zach, for this fabulous and always poignant podcast. I started listening in October 2023 when I discovered quilting and have not missed an episode since. Rating and reviewing because you always ask so nicely in your opening, and I want everyone with an interest in textiles to know about this." The next part is written in all capital letters. Addie says, "Must listen!" Exclamation point. Addie, I am thrilled that you have been on this Seamside ride of me since October last year. Thank you also for taking the time out of your day to write a review. I really do appreciate it. If you are getting something out of these Seamside conversations and you want to make sure other people know about the magic that's happening here, the best way to do it is to leave me a review. And who knows, maybe next time I'll be reading yours at the top of the episode. Thank you so much. While I'm thanking people, let me just give a special thanks to the good folks over at the Quilty Nook. Without your support, projects like Seamside just wouldn't be possible. So I really do appreciate it. Now, the last few episodes, I've been talking about that new ebook I made, my fancy PDF called 10 Things I Wish I'd Known Before I Started Quilting. I wrote it with the hopes that it might save you a little blood, sweat, and tears. Listen to reflection number 7. It's a hot take. It says, "Quantity over quality." If you're interested in really finding out what your quilts look like, the quilts that you can make and nobody else, my advice to you, if you want it, is just to make a bunch. And don't even worry whether it's going to be quote unquote good. There's some magic in just simply repeating the process, going through the idea generation process for a piece and then doing it again and again and again, that naturally helps kind of hone you down a certain path. That's what I mean when I say quantity over quality. The quality will take care of itself. If you want to check out the other 9 reflections in this booklet, check out the link in the show note below. I'll zip it right over to you and you'll be reading 10 Things I Wish I Knew Before I Started Quilting in no time. Now, on a slightly technical note, but one I think you're going to like, I've gotten kind of smart. I have figured out how to divide these podcasts into chapters and often add images to go with the work that the artist is talking about. So throughout the course of this conversation with Barbara, look down at your phone from time to time. If she's referencing a piece of work, I'm going to try to have it on your screen. If you like that, let me know. It's a little bit of work, but if you're digging it, I'm happy to do it. You know how to get a hold of me. So many ways. Now, on with the show. Barbara Campbell Thomas had a long-established painting practice when, about a decade ago, her mother, out of the blue, bought her a sewing machine. Little did she know, but that gift provided her the perfect missing piece to her creative practice that she didn't even know she was looking for. What draws me to Barbara's work is the balance between tautness and texture. Her stretched and pieced canvas quilt works push back on this all-or-nothing perspective on genre. Is it a painting? Is it a quilt? I don't know. Her work, though, is naturally generative and generous, creating expanses that can hold so much. In this Seamside conversation, Barbara and I explore the value of a regular sketchbook practice, even if you don't draw, maybe especially if you don't draw. We talk about what even is abstraction, and how you too can detect your ancestors at work through your creative practice. I hope you enjoy How to Work with the Matriarchs with painter Barbara Campbell Thomas. Welcome to Seamside, Barbara.
Thank you. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you because we have multiple points of connection. One, our friend Paolo Rao.
Absolutely.
Sweetheart.
Absolutely.
Also, you teach at the alma mater of my partner, the University of North Carolina in Greensboro.
Yes. Yep. So those are both very good connections.
I'm happy to have them with you. Happy to have them with you. Now, I heard you recently on a podcast, Sound and Vision, which is wonderful. And if folks want to go kind of dive into your bio and things like that, I would highly recommend they go listen to that Sound and Vision episode. But I was furiously writing notes as you were talking because I have so many things that I want to unpack with you about what you said. Before we jump into all that, though, Barbara, can you tell us where you are right now? Set the scene for us.
Sure. So I am actually sitting on the floor in my house, which is located in a little tiny town called, actually, I don't even think it's a town. It's that small, called Climax, North Carolina.
I've heard of Climax.
You very well may. So out in the countryside, it is, you know, deep spring here in the South. Mm-hmm. And so everything is in bloom and it's just a really beautiful morning here. It's quiet because my son is off at school and my husband is off doing whatever he's doing. I have been up since before 5 because I have a deadline looming. And actually, I know it sounds crazy, but early mornings are for me a real time of spaciousness. And so I like to get up early because I go to my studio, I work on painting, and that's what I was doing this morning. I got some walking in, did have to do a little bit of work, and just really thought about this conversation too.
Oh, I think we're primed and ready to go then.
I think so.
One thing I heard you say, Barbara, in that conversation on sound and vision is that when you make a quilt, if you make a quilt, to get the quote right, you do it as a painter. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, how does a painter make a quilt? Because I feel like this might be a good kind of doorway, entryway into your practice.
Yeah. You know, that was one of these things that kind of fell out. And it, when I said, because I listened to it later, and I thought, oh, that's such a particular thing, this notion of when I make a quilt, I make it as a painter. And I think it really connects to me to this way that we acquire our knowledge, like the knowledge that is super particular to who we are as people. And knowledge isn't quite the right word, I would say, maybe in the context of this, but it's like, as we gather kind of what it is to be who we are, I think that there's a lot that goes into that for each of us that's so particular. And for me, painting is this enormous kind of grounding touch point for my life. It was this entryway into a kind of, I don't know, light bulb moment of like, suddenly when I learned to paint, the world made so much more sense. And so it's because of that, I can't help but take that understanding now, and it carries through like literally everything that I do. And so part of that too, for me, was like a really particular understanding of the material of paint and a real love of the material of paint and the sense that that material had a kind of vastness to it. And so I think that's, for me, that's almost like an orientation. And some people, you know, I found that in paint. Some people find it in other media. But so I can as easily drop that understanding as I can, like, my own skin. So I carry that with me in anything that I do when it comes to making. And so when I learn to quilt, it's like that knowledge just folded right on inside that sort of shell of painting, I would say. And so now they're just sort of like woven together in a way that just I have to believe is particular. And just as I think that for anyone, say making a quilt who is, I don't know, say a yoga practitioner or has something else in there, you know, I think that these are the things that make what we do so precise.
Yeah, those moments of overlap in the Venn diagram of all the tools and forms of expression that we gather as we
move through the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I like to think that because of that, there is a certain imperative, like no pressure artist, but there is a certain imperative that you have a very particular skill set and you are the only person that can do that thing,
yeah.
right? That idea that lives in your head, you're the only person that can bring that into reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, no pressure, but let's get to work.
Oh yeah. And I mean, I so believe that. I mean, that, and the other part of this, I would say the other part of me and I think so much who I am is I've been a teacher for many years, a teacher of artists. And I have the experience of making work for many, many years, but then I also have the experience of working with artists and teaching artists and just watching them and absorbing them and watching so many young people kind of come into who they are as an artist, which is this truly extraordinary thing to witness. And so now, and I've been doing that for about 20 years. And so now I mean, this will connect to what you're saying, but I have this sense, and I say this to them, you know, that every single one of us comes into this world and we have this like incredibly precise, specific, particular vision thing that we're supposed to say, that we're supposed to bring to the world. And it's like our duty to do that. And that very thing is the way that we connect to each other because we all have it, you know?
That's right. I'm really vibing with the word vocation recently.
Hmm.
Like the duty that you mentioned, that the vision that we all carry, that individual singular vision, for me, I'm calling it vocation. Mm-hmm. And that feels pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
At some point later in our conversation, Barbara, I want to circle back and hear how you feel like 20 years of being an educator has influenced your own personal practice. So let's make sure we work our way back there too, because
absolutely.
I'm curious about that. So you said when you make a quilt, you make it as a painter and you learned a quilt from your mom, mm-hmm. right? When you found quilting, you said that felt like the missing piece mm-hmm. for your practice. Can you talk about the phenomenon of the missing piece?
Sure. So, and I can also just relay a little bit of the narrative of that moment, because it very much was a kind of light bulb moment for me as an artist. So my mother, as you know, I know this is a narrative that many people have, but she is a quilter and she actually came relatively late to quilting. She picked it up in her retirement as some do. And so she just had this sense that it would be something that, or at least learning to sew would be something that would be good for me, or that, I don't know, she had this sense. And so she bought me a sewing machine once for my birthday.
And this was about when?
This was about 10 years ago. So relatively recently, she bought me this sewing machine. And it wasn't something I had asked for, but I was delighted to receive it. And in this sort of busyness of life, of course, the sewing machine kind of just sat. And I think she knew that that was going on. So she said to me, well, I'm going to come down, and I think under the auspices of coming to visit her grandson, she came down and she said, all right, I'm going to teach you how to make a quilt. And so she came down, showed me how to use my sewing machine, and we made a little tiny kind of lap quilt in a day. So she showed me how everything works. And it was just such a delightful experience, of course, having that experience with her. And then particularly that for me, the action of piecing, which was completely intuitive for me, it was like, because we were doing this inside my house, there was a connection to my studio outside. It felt like the same thinking. It felt like the same orientation, except the material was different. And so it was like, I mean, I had this sense that it was what I had been looking for, and I didn't even know I had been looking for this. But the other thing that started to happen for me, because I'm an abstract painter, and I went to art school, all of that, took art history classes, and knew pretty quickly that I was an abstract painter. And the degree to which there were so few abstract painters in the history that I was taught was just so notable to me, and has been a factor in my life as an artist. And so I realized that just 100 years ago, I probably would not be making abstract paintings. I would have been making quilts. So that was the other thing, is that like there was this sense of, just given the nature of history and culture and all of this, that's what I would have been doing. And somehow that felt really impactful to me as an artist. So I very much felt like suddenly this thing that I had been waiting for sort of arrived, this sort of knowledge being passed on.
I mean, that thread that connects painting and textiles for you, I mean, feels transcendent, like through time, right? Mm-hmm. Connecting you through multiple generations and also connecting you to other people doing similar work today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's how it felt, kind of out of time.
Yeah. Do you still have that quilt that you made with your mom? That first
I
one?
Do. I do. Actually, it is in my studio. It's a cushion. It's folded up, and it's the cushion that I use at my sketchbook table. So I sit on it every day.
I love it. Because sometimes first quilts get away from us, you know, because we might not realize how crazy we're going to be for quilting. So we give it away.
Yeah.
Yeah. My first quilt was a baby quilt for a good friend. And I reached out to him maybe about 5 years ago to see if he still had my first ever quilt. He's like, oh, I think we lost it in the move. And I was like, likely story, Adam. What's interesting to me is that you haven't left painting for textiles, right? Like you're holding both the hands. You're in a happy, balanced relationship with both of them. What does working with textiles allow you to do in your practice that in hindsight paint wasn't giving you as much access to?
Mm. Well, it's so interesting because it, you know, in a way it's very, very practical, which is, so as a painter, and this isn't always what defines a painter, but I still stretch essentially a canvas over stretcher bars and then apply paint. And so that initial substrate, which is, you know, most often cloth, typically is one big piece of fabric. And at least, you know, that's how it's been taught. And it's so funny because there are definitely, I would say, notions of kind of painterly purity connected to that notion of the unblemished or the uncut surface of a painting. It's interesting to think back on this now. Like I realized that I didn't want to accept that initial layer as a given. Like I didn't want it's sort of being just one piece of fabric wasn't enough or it wasn't working. And so literally learning how to piece was the means by which I could just make that initial layer whatever I needed it to be. And so that's become foundational. I mean, it's foundational to the practice at this point. And it is just as enjoyable and immersive and important, I would say, an act as adding the paint as painting.
It allows you to complicate the surface. My friend Heidi likes to complicate things. So it allows you to complicate the surface, but to do it in a way that feels highly intentional.
Yes.
Right? Absolutely. That little piece of patchwork didn't just slip in there by accident.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and I think because the way that I tend to work is, you know, fairly intuitively, like sometimes I'll have a very, very loose basic structure that I'm thinking about. And there is a way in which just the process itself is so much a means of discovery. And the painting, you know, the direction of the painting really gets set through that initial layer.
Some of the most interesting images that I feel like you post about your work are when you share the backside, the inside of the canvas, because then that's where the textile folks can step up and be like, I see what's happening here.
Yes.
From the front, it can be a little bit, you know, you leave us scratching our heads in a fun way. Is this paint? Is this fabric?
Yeah.
There's this really interesting tension in your work between like tautness, yet still maintaining texture, right? Like you haven't stretched it so far out that there's not texture to your work. Mm-hmm. And then you flip over to the back of the canvas and that's where you see the seam side, if you will,
yes.
Right? The seam allowance is poking out. And that to me is also equally beautiful and fascinating.
Yeah. And that feels to me right now like an open question because the seam side is important and it is an important way for people to see how the work is made. And I've at times put some of that on the front and haven't quite figured out how to work with that at the moment. So it is one of these things in the practice that, it feels like an open question that I just kind of am pondering. what is the presence of that? How does it relate? And I think, you know, you bring up some of the ways in which there's can be a kind of confusion or a not full clear understanding of what they are initially. And I've had that. I've had people say that. And I've had people, when they see them in person, kind of express some real surprise as to what they look like, because they present in one way over photographs. And actually, recently, you know, I had a breakthrough. I have someone who helps me with the photography, and he said, you know, I realized that actually I have to photograph your work the way I photograph sculpture in order for it to start to be perceivable what's going on. So that makes so much sense.
Like photographing sculpture, meaning maybe from different angles, close-ups, like what was he referencing there?
He was, I think, really referencing the way, I think initially he was, in a way, kind of diffusing the lighting so that he was minimizing the texture. And when he started to change the lighting to allow for more of the surface texture, because there is a lot, there's the sewn aspect, there's the painted aspect, and then there's also collage that's added.
And embellished, sometimes you add buttons and such, right? Like,
yeah,
some of them really get,
yeah,
off the surface. Yeah.
Yeah. So all of that is also still a question for me in terms of the ways in which I can more adequately or sort of accurately conveys some of that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I often think of, like, a lot of my pieces are wall pieces, right? They're meant to be hung on the wall. And so I've had pieces that I really did not finish the back, right? Because in my mind, I think, oh, if I were a painter, no one would even think about flipping the canvas over and looking at the backside. No one would even care. That's not where the value of the object is. But quilting, looking back on those pieces where I didn't finish the back, they just feel unfinished to me for my practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I think it's because for me, quilts are sculptural objects that need to live in three-dimensional space, even if they spend most of their time hanging on a wall.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. That makes sense to me. Absolutely. Well, because there's something about, and this is something I'm also kind of, it's also another kind of question in my studio, because I'm in the midst of working on some pieces that are not stretched, and they are so hard for me to understand right now. Like, I don't know how to think about them, but I still have this compulsion to make them. And I think it is because when they're stretched, that edge of the canvas is, it's just like this magical thing. I always think of the edge of a painting as being like this place of possibility, and also like connected to the history of like kind of painting as illusion. Like there are things about that that sort of delve into more than the material itself. And so I don't yet know, like, how does the edge translate when it's not stretched? So that's the thing that I'm sort of not sure how to deal with. And that's the thing, is that I've immediately started thinking, well, how will the back be dealt with? Because I don't know. I don't know that I can just leave it. So there's something in that. Someone could write some kind of like really interesting, like very theory heavy essay about that, I'm sure.
That I would read and not understand at all. But talking to you, I get it. Yeah, it makes me think of so many things. It makes me think of, recently I was talking with Coulter Fussell, who definitely treats, well, no, I don't want to say that. I feel like she treats her pieces equally sculptural and painterly. But she recently made some frame pieces, which is not typical for her work, right? She loves that edge, like you were saying, where the piece meets the wall and what can happen in that kind of liminal space, right? But she wanted to frame this certain collection because, let's be honest, there's commercial, like, buyers understand what to do with framed objects.
Yes.
Right? So if you're making work to pay the bills, consider framing it, right?
Yeah. And,
but she didn't want frames that really took away from the work. So she made these really skinny little wooden frames that just barely obscure. She's living with it. It's what you would call a question in her practice at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, she's figured it out. But
Yeah.
Similarly, it makes me think in my own practice that my pieces are venturing more and more towards natural silhouettes. Like, I will start a lot with old quilts, or even just like commercial quilts I found at the thrift store or something, and then applique quilt tops on top of those old quilts with the intention at the beginning of like cutting it off or like squaring it up, air quotes. But I find that by the time I get to the end of the piece, I'm so in love with the way like the old quilt kind of sticks out from the back and how the old quilt and the new pieces combined suggest a whole new silhouette. And I'm like, I can't hack this up. I'll leave it the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
But those edges, those silhouettes really are a significant piece.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you.
One thing you said in the conversation that I really am excited to hear more about, because you kind of glossed over it on Sound and Vision, was this idea of matrilineal abstraction. And you said you grew up in a home, you were surrounded by matrilineal abstraction. Mm-hmm. Barbara, please tell us more. What does that mean?
Yeah, this is something that I've kind of, I guess, I don't know that we could say that I've coined this, but connected to this understanding of who I am as an artist, as an abstract painter, again, in response to the sense of, okay, well, if I didn't sort of have, in a way, a kind of strong history of, say, women making abstract paintings, then I just determined that I needed to find that history for myself. So in a way, like, yeah, what is my own art history? Who are the people who make that history, that art history up? And so, and there's so many people who comprise that art history and so many, I don't know, aspects and materials that aren't even necessarily art per se, but somehow have found a place. And I think of late, I have really been thinking about, well, why am I so drawn to abstraction? And one of the things that I've really realized is that it was so much in my home, and it was so much in my home through the things that were made by the women in my family. And in particular, I, in the last year, have become incredibly fascinated with this rug, this rag rug that was made by my great-great-grandmother. And her name was Edna Otto Fame. And she made these rugs out of cut up old coats. And a couple ended up with my mom, and they were in the house and we used them. You know, we walked on them. You know, I remember the one that I have right now. It was in this little alcove sort of hallway that we walked through countless times. So things like that, and there are a lot of things like that. You know, I haven't yet really looked into if this was like a thing that was done in the 40s or something, in the 1940s and earlier, but she collected a ton of buttons and she made these really elaborate arrangements of them. And so we had those as well. My mother framed those, and those are in the house. And they were these things that were, I just was fascinated by them. And they were about geometry. They were about color, texture, surface. They were adamantly made by hand. They were made in the fabric of her life. She ran a country store. She was a farmer. And yet she also had this incredible output as a creative person. And of course, all of that necessarily had to be fit within the rhythms of the life that she was living. And so that, all of that, like everything I've just laid out in a way, is kind of a template for my own life. This sort of, this fascination with geometry, color, texture. And since, you know, my children arrived now 19 years ago, this way in which a practice is fit within the rhythms of a life. And so here was this amazing example of that, literally in my own history. And I then thought, well, what if art history could get to the place where there was room for these kinds of people? And also because I think so often abstraction is, at least, is often taught as being so separate from life and being kind of, I don't know, living off in this sort of like lofty, like not connected to just like the mess of what it is to be human. That's never worked for me. Like that definition of abstraction, just, it's never sat well. It hasn't felt accurate. And once again, I think for me to figure out why meant that I had to define it newly. And so I want to know, like, how is matrilineal abstraction, like, it's not just something that is in my life. Like, how does it play out in other people's lives? Like, what might be the impact of these kinds of objects, surfaces that have inhabited so many of our homes, that have influenced potentially so many people? I don't know. What's the place of that? You know, how does that fit within the kind of constellation of artist thinking in this world right now? So that's, for me, this notion of matrilineal abstraction is a kind of broadening of the definition of abstraction and a real, I think, call to find these anchor points in our personal histories and value those so that other people can value that in their own history.
I have so many more questions than I did 5 minutes ago, and we're going to get to them.
Good.
But it makes me think, you listing off the matrilineal objects in your own childhood makes me think, what are mine?
Yeah. Right?
And one of the first two things that come to mind, I'm like, oh, that's so fascinating. One is more of an image of my mom sitting at the kitchen table practicing calligraphy, which she would do. You know, when you're learning to write calligraphy, you just do a lot of strokes over and over and over, because the idea is you got to do it a million times so that it appears graceful and effortless.
Yeah.
So there's this real kind of discipline and grunt work that goes into something that looks graceful and effortless in the end. And I see that now in the way that I work as well, which is a lot of it's kind of under the table, under the radar. And what is seen publicly is the tip of the iceberg. I also think the other matrilineal object, and this is a true object at this point, was when I was maybe about 15 years old, my aunt, we all grew up on the same land together out in the country. My aunt was designing a mural of a mermaid for the art supply store that she worked at. And so this mural was floor to ceiling mermaid, as you can imagine. And I think, oh, that's so fascinating, because you got scale here. Like, I love huge wall size pieces. Here's my aunt modeling for me. Big wall size pieces. My mom was working with text. I work a lot with text in my textile work.
Wow.
I'm like, oh, okay. So you said light bulb moments.
Yes.
I think I just had light bulb moments.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But those are such, they're such anchoring moments. I remember watching my grandmother arrange things on the walls of our house. And I literally remember like the cadence of her body as it moved through the space and the way that she put things on the wall and the spaces in between. And that sense of arrangement absolutely is something that comes into play in my own work.
And there's something almost mystical about that, listening to you share that memory, right? That it's not just her sticking something on a wall in any old place. No, right. She's, I'm imagining, considering and making adjustments and nuances that you as a little person, as a young person, probably didn't understand. Why is she doing it just that way? Why is 1 inch to the left different than 1 inch to the right? But she knew. She knew.
And she was always right. I mean, that was the thing, is that I would look at how she would arrange the plate next to this wooden spoon. And somehow there's this consideration. I mean, it's all the things that we learn our first year as a young art student. And she was a phys ed major in college. And yet there's like this sense of that understanding that absolutely was real palpable to me in like wordless ways.
Do you encourage your students to know their lineage, to know their own personal histories when it comes to the art that they're working on?
So much of my work as a teacher is talking one-on-one with students and getting to know who they are and through the work that they make and the things that they show me. And so I always, when I start to recognize those kinds of inclinations or when they bring me things that are connected, say, to family or past, I always encourage them to dig deeper. I have not, and this is interesting to me to think about, you know, I haven't really designed an entire assignment explicitly about this, which I think would be really fascinating. So that's going to have to happen.
I want to do that assignment. Would you share with me when you're done?
Okay, I will.
Why would you, like, what's your elevator pitch, huh, Barbara? Like, when you say, like, if a student were to say, well, why is it important for me to know my artistic lineage?
I think it makes you, it helps you understand more fully who you are as an artist. And I think it helps you pinpoint, like, we all have these, like, nuances as to who we are and why we do what we do. And I think sometimes those nuances, it's like they're not even perceivable to us yet. And then you'll have a moment like, you know, you talking about watching your mother make those marks as she was working with calligraphy. Then you'll have a moment and you're like, oh my gosh, that's it. That's why. And I just think our bodies are just like packed full of those kinds of experiences that have a yield in terms of the things that we make. And I think that's a lifelong process, kind of understanding all of that. But I think as we can just give space for that knowledge kind of unfolding, I think we just figure out who we are more.
And who we are, especially like in the Western sense, often feels very atomized and individualized, which I feel like can do, I'm sure it's got some perks, but I also feel like it sets us up for more work than may be necessary, right? This whole idea of like finding your voice and discovering yourself, all of which is important, but I would say that a lot of that work's already been done for us if we reflect on our ancestors, how they moved through the world, because they gave us the programming with which we often move through the world.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think it really helps us push against these notions even of kind of isolation, you know, which I think is a really big thing, certainly for, like, I think about that for young artists going out into the world. And so often the things that make people stop working is this sense of isolation. But I think the more that you can kind of see that we're made up of so much that has come before us. And I'm fascinated by that. It just makes everything feel that much more endless.
A moment ago, when you first started talking about the idea of abstraction, you said that there's this notion, there's this definition of abstraction that is very remote from like the personal experience, the lived experience. There's this idea that you want to push back on. You said that's not your definition, but you haven't shared with us what your definition is. Mm. So what is, at this point in time, Barbara Campbell Thomas's definition of abstraction as it appears in your work?
That's such a great question. For me, abstraction and literally engaging in abstraction on a daily basis in the making of this work, because that is what I feel like I'm doing. I'm engaging in a visual language that I can't put a name to, or I can't string together a series of words that sort of makes the picture of what I'm making appear in your mind. And there's a way in which engaging in abstraction, you know, so persistently, again, for so many years, like for me, is very much this kind of acknowledgement that there is more than what I can see, that somehow my existence in the world is informed by way more than that. And it's informed through, of course, through touch, through the way that my body moves through space, through experience, through memory, through pain, through, you know, the things that have been difficult. And I was thinking, I don't know why I was thinking about this morning, I think because I knew maybe that we would talk about abstraction. And I continue to think about, why is it so important to me that I work with languages of abstraction? So, and this is very personal too, but I have an older brother who has, throughout his whole life, has just had a series of physical and mental disabilities. So knowing that as a young person, like being a kid and not really knowing kind of why he felt different and what to do with that. Also, like, knowing that that was kind of big, like these kind of questions, and not knowing how to, like, just not having the logic in a way to kind of grapple with things like this. I feel like at that moment, I knew that there was more. There, like, logic could only get you so far, and the easily answered question could only get you so far, and that there had to be so much more. So for me, like, there are ways in which it's like very adamantly personal, and it's very adamantly about like bodies that work and bodies that work differently and bodies that don't sit in the world the way the world wants them to. And so what do we do with all of that? You know, I think those kinds of sort of anchoring questions are so much for me connected to thinking about abstraction. And that, even just attempting to answer it, like, I feel like I've kind of gone on this like meandering sort of journey, and I could have a long way to go to keep thinking through it.
Well, it's a question of a lifetime.
Yeah.
If you had a pat answer, it wouldn't be an interesting question to pursue.
And I wouldn't keep making this stuff.
That's right. If you could say it all in one piece, it'd be a really small collection. How do you, when you're working with students or somebody who would like to explore more abstraction in their work, do you have some kind of go-to suggestions? Because I'm thinking also, like, in my work, and I'm thinking of people at home listening, like, one of the things I love about text is it's the opposite of abstraction, right? Like it is hyper-specific. I can use these little symbols that we all culturally agree on for the most part, and you can read them in a second, digest them in a second, you'll feel something immediately, and like it's a way of transferring one thought to the next. And the way I think of it is highly poetic. So, you know, the way the text, the way the words come together isn't necessarily logical, rational, and what you might expect. So I'm trying to combine poetry with text to like really hit you. Now, the downside of that is that it could teeter on prescriptive, right? If one isn't careful to say, I want the viewer to experience X. Like I'm not trying to be prescriptive. So I'm always having to like dial it back a little bit. All of that's to say, so someone like me who doesn't use a lot of abstraction in their work, who might be interested in incorporating some of that in their practice, do you have some go-to tips or thoughts that you share with your students?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things that something that I do for myself in my own practice is almost like, okay, well, let's take reality, or let's take things that are nameable, letters, this drawing that you made of a tree or whatever. I mean, I also really love collage. And so I'm a huge proponent of let's just cut that up and make it again, but in a different way. And that's something, honestly, I do a ton of. And I do it a ton of with letters, actually, as well, because there is this way in which I'm fascinated with, well, let's make something that's letter-like, but is not legible. And those are kind of like games, or those are the kinds of things that they're like puzzles. So I often will have students do things like that. Let's make a drawing where we're just trying to generate as many reds as we can invent. And let's just arrange them in swatches and then cut those up. And so I do a lot of this kind of generating and then cutting up and then recombining and then cutting up and sort of through the process of almost like, it's almost like generational. It's like, let's go, can we go like three generations from this like first layer? What do we have, you know, as we kind of move through? So that,
and what are you looking for through the multiple passes?
I am always looking for something that surprises me, or something that I feel like I've not quite seen, or something that feels like it has a kind of, maybe a kind of visual agency, like say through movement or certain rhythms. So those are the things that often I will look for. And then the other great thing, I think, which is hugely helpful, is working with time. And so we'll do 10-minute drawings or 5-minute drawings, or just working with, here, take these shapes or take these materials and set the timer, just generate stuff. So anything really, I'm super interested in anything that helps us get like to that different level of thinking that isn't just like sitting right on top.
Yeah, one of my favorite things that we've ever done on the Nook, you know, I help host this online community for textile artists. And last June, we had our first annual quilt race. And this June, we're going to have our second annual. And the whole idea is to make a quilt top in under an hour for the reasons that you're just saying. Like, how can we ratchet up the pressure on ourselves so much that there is zero room for like piddling?
Yeah.
Right. Like Emin and Holland just sitting around thinking. Right. And it was incredible to see the work that people came out with after an hour.
Oh, I love
it. And some of it was all just like pinned down or whatever. I don't care. The idea, though, is to just like open up something, unleash some kind of a beast that doesn't get to come out and play very often.
Yes. And then you have to, on some level, you have to dispense with whatever your definition of what a quilt is, because it's not going to fit within that hour. And so that kind of thing I just love, because it just makes you think, oh, okay, well, wait, there are more definitions of quilting actually than this one. And so like, let's just find them. So that's fascinating to me. I love that. It makes me really excited.
Oh, well, you're welcome to join us. We'd love to have you.
Okay.
I know that you have a rich sketchbook practice. You told us that you sit on the very first quilt that you ever made with your mom. And you sit on that as you sketch. Can you share a little bit about your practice of sketching with
us? Sure. Okay. So that's also has a textile aspect to it. And that is, so once again, this mother who's been so critical for me in my practice. So she, about probably about the same time that she taught me how to quilt, started sending me these these sketchbooks that she covered. She kind of quilted these covers, and she would send these to me. So then it started like another like birthday gift or something that she gave. She sent me one of these, and I loved it and filled it. And then she sent me another one. And then I think she kind of realized that I was really loving these. And so she just has continued to send these to me. I probably have about 25 of these now, like all with these covers that she has made. And so in a way, that has brought my sketchbook practice to this other place, because there is this kind of collaboration in a way, or this conversation with her. So for me, my sketchbook practice has always been this space of immense permission. I think as artists, we all need something like that. And it's not, you know, a sketchbook practice for everyone. And I will say, because I think what's important to say, I don't sit and draw, you know, like with a pencil, or I'm not like drawing the world, or I'm not spending hours and hours on pages in my sketchbook. It's a practice that's, again, connected to who I am as an artist and what interests me. And so tons of collage, tons of working with marker, saturated color, sometimes fabric, a lot of kind of what I would say almost is like game playing in my sketchbook. So like when I was talking about earlier, these like inventing different letters, I do things like that in my sketchbook, which sometimes make their way into the paintings and sometimes just never do. But I really think of this, again, of the sketchbooks as this space in which I am able to do anything I want as an artist. And that's how I think about my sketchbook practice. So, you know, I share some of the pages sometimes on Instagram. I've done that, but mostly they're pretty personal. And they're really a way in which I think I'm able to kind of process who I am, you know, my interior life, but also I can play, I can experiment, I can try new things. I would say the most important thing, and this is because I do teach a sketchbook class, and the thing I really try to convey to my students is my sketchbook practice is, I love it. You know, I love the time. I love the time that I spend in these books. It's so much fun. It's so completely pleasurable. And that's partially why they're so rich, because they're so enjoyable to me. And so that has meant that there's stuff that I just don't do because I don't find it enjoyable. So I think like really thinking about like, what are the rules that you have for a sketchbook? Oftentimes my students will be like, well, but I've got to spend hours and hours on this page. And I'm like, no, I mean, if you want to, you know, I don't want to do that. So I'm not going to do it. So, I think that the sketchbook practice has, in a way, it's a kind of ethos, I would say, that has to be present in my practice as an artist. And when I don't keep up on them, when they're not active, it usually means my studio practice is not active either. There's definitely like, they're like the canary in the coal mine or something. The indicator of the overall health of things for me creatively is the sketchbook practice.
I love that you referred to your sketchbook practice as a space where the artist can do anything, because we don't often think of artists as having putting creative limitations or like squeezing themselves into some kind of creative process box. I don't think about that very often, but I do love just this unfettered freedom to play in the privacy of a book that you can just shut and put away on the shelf if you want.
Yeah. Yeah. And they become, you know, like thinking about back to what you were saying about like a quilt that's kind of sculptural, you know, they're very sculptural. And when they pile up, they become these very adamantly physical objects. So that's kind of an interesting facet of them, bursting at the seams with all of this stuff.
Yeah. It's kind of like a cairn to, isn't that the word cairn? Like on a hiking trail where you have like a stack of stones, and then a cairn or a cairn?
Yes.
Or a cairn.
Yeah. I don't know how to
It's like a cairn to, I don't know either, but the image, y'all got the image. It's a stack of stones.
Yep.
Of your matrilineal abstraction lineage, right? It's at least two generations. I love that you and your mom are working on that together.
For sure.
How does your sketchbook practice fit into your routine, like on a practical level? You do it in the morning?
I tend to do it in the morning, but it's also sometimes like when I just need to kind of unwind or Or if I'm in the middle of working on something in my studio and I feel like I'm kind of stuck, you know, sometimes I'll take a break and work in the sketchbook. Sketchbooks are really huge when I'm traveling. Like that's like the, that's kind of like the portable studio in a way. And so I think that sketchbooks, at least for me, fit in really well when I'm able to travel, because it's, say if I'm traveling to another country, it's that's also an experience that's so much about like just really being open to like seeing new things. And so that's like, it's a perfect moment to work in a sketchbook.
How often do you look back?
I don't very often, but I will say one of the things that I have been doing, I typically, before the start of a new year, will look over the sketchbooks from the previous year and do a kind of summation in whatever the recent sketchbook that I'm working with in, where I'll kind of go through and in a way sort of pull out what seems to have been like the most important or like kind of fruitful, or maybe also like the ideas that really feel like they haven't been touched upon yet, but seem like maybe they will. And I'll kind of like almost like copy the sketchbooks into, it's sort of a strange thing. Like I'll like copy little drawings, or I'll kind of make little mini versions of other pages, sort of like the annotation of my own year's previous sketchbook, like as a way to kind of summarize the visual ideas. So it's like very kind of folding in on itself in a way.
Yeah, you're making an index, a personal index.
Oh, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. Yeah, that's perfect. So I try to do it at least once a year, because it is really helpful for me to kind of look back and see what I've been thinking about.
So Barbara, where's your sketchbook practice taking you these days? What are you working on?
So I've been working with a lot of marker, making these expanses. It's kind of how I'm thinking about it. Literally striping, like stripes of color that become surfaces, and sometimes they'll get cut up and they'll get generated into subsequent pages. But they are, like, I'm really thinking a lot right now in the paintings that I'm making. I'm thinking a lot about, well, let me back up for one second. So maybe about a couple of months ago, I was approached about having an exhibition this summer with a woman who is a landscape painter. And I thought it was a really interesting pairing. And then I started to think about the fact that I less am working with external landscape, but I'm quite interested in kind of interior landscape, or say the space of our minds, and how would we even think about sort of conceptualizing that? And that began to dovetail with thinking about just the fact that I just make a lot of surfaces. Like I've been doing that for decades now, like these expanses. And that is also a kind of landscape, you know? So I think that there are some ways in which like I'm playing with that in the sketchbook as a way to kind of figure out some visual ideas that will head into the paintings. And so there's a lot of kind of striation, but then I'm also making some paintings where I'm kind of like dissolving those edges. I don't know. And this is of course why I make paintings, because like I have these sort of like rough anchor ideas, and then it's like I have to make them to kind of see them come into existence.
Makes sense to me. You got anything coming down the pike that you're especially excited about?
So yeah, so I am going to be showing in a two-person show in July at a gallery in Charlottesville called the Zoo du Monde, and that will be with an artist named Isabel Abbott. So that's the show that I'm really working on right now.
Is that the same show you were just describing about landscape? And
yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So those are the things that I'm really thinking about right now. And I also will have a show in the fall at a gallery outside of Chicago called Studio Break Gallery, run by an artist. And that show, that's the show that I'm really thinking about trying to make work that is unstretched, because I'm literally thinking about trying to get the work there and the ease of shipping.
Oh, yeah.
And right now, again, it's a lot of big open questions. I've made some things for that show, but have not figured out how to bring them to conclusion.
Well, we're excited to follow along and see how it all turns out for you.
Thank you.
Barbara, if you had to put a first pass answer down on the table for this question, the thesis question of Seamside, how does working with textiles make us more human? What would you say at this point in your life?
I would say that for me, working with textiles has been the way that I have connected who I am with the fact that I exist in this greater network of ideas, of people, of those who have supported me, of those who have gone before me. It's really been the way, I mean, you know, as I said earlier, this kind of light bulb moment of working this with this material that felt kind of like, it did truly feel almost like kind of cosmic. And that suddenly this like space of conversation opened up between me and all of these women who came before me, who have helped me become the painter that I am and the person that I am. So yeah, it's just, it's, I love the notion. I mean, it's truly, it's like, it's made me more who I am, more human.
I love too that, especially in your work, thinking of the long line of artistic and creative matriarchs in your family, that a key impulse for you was to break the monolith of the canvas and to subdivide it into various parts. And yet you still also want to maintain at the same time these expanses, as you're calling them, right? You want to have all this room, but not in a way that monopolizes the canvas or the piece. And I love that I see that room making and that space making in your work.
I love that.
Barbara, I am so thankful for this conversation. I think, just on a personal note, I will be thinking quite a bit about my matrilineal abstraction streak in my family. Well, maybe not abstraction. I'll be thinking about my matrilineal creative streak that has formed my own practice for quite a long time. Like those images of my mom at the kitchen table, my aunt in the garage working on the mural. Like none of this is an accident or a mistake. And so I thank you for giving me those two dots to ponder the connection between. Thank you.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I'm thrilled. Thank you so much for having me here to talk about all this. And it's been such a pleasure.
I should tell you, we'll probably do this again in a year, but I'll tell you about that after we go off. Barbara, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I had a genuine aha moment thinking about my mom writing calligraphy at the kitchen table and my aunt working on a mermaid mural. How about you? I'd love to hear about it. Feel free to share on social media. If you tag me, I'll reshare it. Now, if you want to hear three artists that Barbara thinks everybody should know, we got that listed on the episode website. So click over there. I hadn't heard of any of the three of them, and looking at their work, I am so glad that they're on my radar now. Check out that link for the episode website, and it'll take you right there. If you would like to nominate someone to be on the Seamside podcast, maybe you want to nominate yourself. That's good too. There's a link in the show notes for nominating guests. I would love to know who you would love to hear on this show. With all that said, I'll be back next week with another chat. Until then, I hope you're well. I hope you're sowing something good. And I hope to see you soon. Maybe on the Nook. Who knows?